Welcome to Innovation Alberta, a celebration of science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Crocher. It might take a quantum leap to change the way computers work, storing information in beams of light, but Dr. Barry Sanders figures his work in quantum information science at the University of Calgary is making great strides towards that end. And Dr. Kaz Schmoyka at the Alberta Research Council is harnessing light for a different purpose, and that's to provide an alternate source of heat to the burning of natural gas. And ecologist Dr. Phil Lee from the University of Alberta is expanding our understanding of integrated landscape management, and that's by looking at how oil and gas development is changing Alberta's boreal forest. These stories coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. If you're an internet junkie, your life dependent on the latest bid on eBay or your next purchase from Amazon.com, what would you do if all that came to an abrupt end? We like to believe that encryption systems are secure so that personal information and credit card numbers sent over the internet don't end up in the wrong hands. But with the advance of technology, it's only a matter of time before that bubble of illusion bursts, and that will happen when quantum computers hit the scene. Dr. Barry Sanders is one scientist who's making strides in that arena. Barry holds an ICOR chair in quantum information science and is director of the Institute for Quantum Information Science at the University of Calgary.
Quantum information science is an area of information science and technology. So it's to do with communication, computation, and it's based on the laws of quantum physics. So whereas all forms of information and communication science and technology to date is based on technologies that take binary strings, zeros and ones, manipulates them, processes them, transmits them. We're trying to create a revolution in information science and technology that's based on replacing zeros and ones, replacing Boolean logic like ANDs or NOT gates by quantum information and by quantum processing.
Well, perhaps you could explain that a bit more. Like, what is quantum as opposed to everything else?
So usually quantum physics is restricted at the atomic level. So we can think about atoms, and they have electrons, and the electrons can be in different levels. So imagine that the level of the electron in an atom could represent information. It could be in the first level or the second level or the third level. But in quantum physics, you're allowed superpositions of different levels. So you can have simultaneous coexistence of different levels. When you turn this over to information science, then you can have simultaneous coexistence of different numbers. So the idea, one of the ideas of quantum information is to take advantage of the quantum world's allowance of simultaneous existence of different realities. So we can have all the different numbers coexist, and we can process them all simultaneously, and we can communicate them simultaneously.
How far along is this science in terms of information?
There's a whole spectrum of activity that goes on. And we have a range from quantum computing, so this would be quantum computers, that would be able to solve some problems that are considered to be impossible to be solved by regular computers ever. And that sort of technology and the algorithms that are used are still in the far future, probably decades away. And so I would put that on the futuristic end of the spectrum. On the other side of it, we have cryptography, quantum cryptography. And for our entire society now, the whole e-commerce base requires all these public key cryptosystems. We put our credit card number over the internet, and we trust that it's somehow encrypted and secure through that encryption. And what really goes on is that the numbers that we encrypt and send over the internet are not totally secure. We just believe that eavesdroppers or adversaries don't have the capability of cracking it. Of course, if they had a quantum computer, it turns out to be easily cracked. So a quantum computer is like the nuclear bomb for the internet. It would completely devastate our entire basis for information security in public systems. So quantum cryptography is a way of creating keys that are absolutely totally secure forever, no matter what technology the opponent has. And those devices are already commercial, that there are at least two companies in the world that are selling devices to be able to do this totally secure quantum information distribution.
Well, you hold the ICOR chair in quantum information science, and you have the institute here. What is it that you're trying to do? What are you working on?
Here in Calgary, we have a number of different projects we're trying to work on. We're trying to get to make quantum information have more immediate practical successes. One of the major focuses we have is we are taking new protocols. So there are protocols such as quantum teleportation and entanglement swapping and then fingerprinting. There's a number of different protocols that are proposed but not yet realized. And one of our major focuses is to do the first realization of various proposals that come out. And we try to do them optically. So we actually have labs here. We have theory work here. And we're trying to do first demonstrations of quantum information protocols to explore their limitations, to figure out how to get around them, and to understand their uses. And a good example of that is we're pushing ahead on authentication. And so when you do cryptography, when you send your credit card number over the internet, the company accepts who you are, but more importantly, you accept that you're sending it to the right place. That's an authentication problem. There's a good example of that. Remember that bank that sent over documents to the junkyard in the U.S.? And they hadn't authenticated. And so when you authenticate, then you know you're sending to the right person. And so we're interested in quantum authentication. We're also very interested in quantum memory. Now, in regular systems, we have RAM and we have disk space. So we have ways to store memory temporarily that's quick. That's our RAM. And we have long-term storage and disk. And we want to be able to store quantum information. And I mentioned to you about the atom with the electron levels. So, for example, if you had quantum information that's encoded in some light beam, and you could put it in an atom and store the electron state in some way, you could store it and then pull it out later. That's representative of what we're trying to do. We're trying to create ways to store quantum information and then release it on demand. And that's something that we take for granted with regular equipment, but not in quantum information. It turns out to be one of the most challenging aspects.
Well, how would you store it in an atom? And does it matter what kind of atom it is?
The trouble with storing in an atom is that it likes to lose it. You know, if you shine light onto some, you know these black lights, and you shine it, and then they glow. And when you shine light onto some particles, they'll glow. That's because even if you put quantum information in the light, it loses it in all directions. It becomes garbage. And so you have to find clever ways of storing the light. There's a famous experiment a few years ago where it was reported that light could be stopped. If this is familiar, so you can shine a light beam through an atomic medium. And then by shining another light beam through, you're able to slow down the light, bring it to a stop, and release it later. And it turns out to be some particular gas of atoms that can store it. So we have labs here that are where they're using rubidium atoms. Rubidium is in the periodic table. It's a kind of atom. And we're creating gas of atoms. And then what we want to do is to be able to stop light and then get it to move again. And what happens is it goes into these electron levels of an atom, but you use other light beams to be able to control so that the atom can't drop into its lowest state and lose the light as garbage. You shine light beams on so that it's forced to hold on to it, and then when you release it, it goes where you want it to go. So we are thinking of ways of having quantum information in light beams and storing it in atoms in that way.
Well, what's so special about the rubidium atom?
Rubidium is not the only atom that we could use, but rubidium has different energy levels. The electrons are kind of high enough up away from the nucleus, and they have a lot of different levels they can access. And what you want to do is to find an atom that has transitions between different energy levels that correspond to optical light that you can make with your laser. So you want to pick an atom that has transitions that are amenable to laser technology and to the mirrors and lenses and beam splitters and the rest of the stuff you use. And also you want to have just the right amount of other levels that are accessible so you can trick the atom into holding quantum information, but not too many because it can lose it to these other levels. So it's just an optimization problem. You try to figure out what are the different atoms you have and try to pick the one that'll do the best job. And then you do controls to try to correct. No atom's perfect. You have to find ways to correct.
What will this ultimately mean to me, Joe Blow?
Oh, the whole quantum information science venture? If we get a quantum computer and we don't do anything else, then that could mean the death of the internet. So, the whole trust in e-commerce and information security. So that could be bad news. But it means something. And then on the other hand, with fortunately at the more feasible end of the spectrum, we have the capability of providing absolutely secure information. So, I mean, for most people, the push for perfectly secure information transfer doesn't seem so important because people are prepared just to believe it is secure. So for the person who believes everything is secure, it will just it will give them the security that isn't there that they shouldn't believe in and make it actually there. Where it becomes important, actually, this technology will never be – well, I shouldn't say never, but it's unlikely that it will wind up on everybody's desktop. Where it really matters is national security for major business efforts, for any place where security really does matter. So if you're going to tell somebody a secret, you know, tell your friend a secret over the internet, it's not terrible if it's broken. But if you have national secrets and they go over public channels, that could be a major problem. As far as quantum computing, when that comes about, that will then have other implications. In addition to information security, probably the most immediate benefit will be that systems that depend on quantum mechanics, like the development of new materials, superconductors, all kinds of weird optical materials, optical circuitry, the photonics revolution, better bandwidth so we can have interactive television, all these things that we do a lot of simulations to figure out what can be developed, but the computers aren't that powerful, and we have to do a lot of expensive experiments and guesswork. And a quantum computer could enable some of those simulations to become feasible, and then it could lead to more rapid discovery of new technologies. So that would be another benefit.
Thank you very much, Barry.
Thank you.
That was Dr. Barry Saunders, ICOR Chair in Quantum Information Science and Director of the Institute for Quantum Information Science at the University of Calgary. Light beams, or radiation from the sun, could very well become the next furnace to heat our homes. For the last 4 years, Dr. Kaz Shmoka has been working in his lab at the Alberta Research Council to develop what he believes is a cost-effective alternative to natural gas space heating, and that's solar insulating panels. 2/3 of the energy a typical house uses is for heating, so Kaz figures that's the best place to focus our energy conservation efforts.
You know, natural gas is a raw material for so many products, which if you look around, you see how many our things we have in our house are coming from natural gas. That keeping in mind that we need that for many, many years in the future, burning of natural gas is not the best way to utilize these resources. In Canada, about 30% of total energy is used by residential housing. So there is a significant potential by everybody here to reduce that if each house can reduce his energy consumption. So far, we are talking about cutting that emissions by 1 ton per house. With solar system, we could cut that emissions by 6 tons per house, and this is very promising. The problem in Alberta we have is just approaching energy crisis, what seems to be very funny when considering the resources we have. But I'm limiting my evaluation only to natural gas reserves. These existing reserves are enough here, keeping in mind proven reserves, for about 8 years. And this is not a very long time. Obviously, the problem comes from excessive exports. We are covering about 16% of North America usage, or actually USA, except for Canada. This is why we might be short of natural gas in quite near future. And if we do not take any way to resolve that problem right now, we might face a very serious crisis in a few years.
Well, you've taken a totally different viewpoint on how we should be dealing with the heating of our house rather than heating it from inside. What do you think?
Our technology differs from a typical approach, and is in this term unconventional, that we are trying to heat our house from outside rather than from inside. The nature of the solar radiation and whole system when we are trying to utilize solar energy is such that we have to work with skin of our house or envelope of our house, and having direct collection of solar radiation and direct heat storage in the envelope makes the cost going very low, and immediately it makes sense to utilize this kind of systems.
How is the system set up?
Usually on the top of our wall outside, we are putting a layer of phase-changing material which has ability to absorb heat and store that heat for nighttime when there is no sun. So as a result of this ability for heat storage and collection during the daytime, we could keep our walls during nighttime warm enough to prevent heat losses.
What is this heat-saving material?
Mostly the hydrated salts. There are many different materials. We are working on that, and we are developing formulas because there are many different components which might be the most reliable, stable, and efficient.
Now, we had a tour of the three experimental mini-houses that you have built outside. Describe the houses for me.
We have three houses, or actually they are models. Each of them is about 10 square meters in terms of floor area. First house is mimicking typical house. So we have our 20 baths, 2x6. This is typical technology used right now in Alberta. Another one is SIP panel, structural insulated panel, which is technology which is supposed to be implemented in the market soon. And we have now a solar house, which is combining SIP panels with solar system.
What's a SIP panel?
SIP panel is a structural insulated panel where two OSB boards are sandwiching a core which is expanded polystyrene core. So styrofoam is the main insulator in this wall. We have these three experimental shelters for purpose of comparing energy consumption, because if you do not have a reference, you cannot answer the question how efficient you are.
So if you had these panels on the outside of the house, do you still need to heat the inside?
What we are trying to do, we are looking for solutions which are most cost-effective. In car industry, it was found that hybrid is the best one. We could say that we've got something like a hybrid solution for housing, where typical system, which still will be present in the house, will be supplemented by solar system. And that solar system will utilize practically everything from environment what is possible.
It looks like you have some design considerations to work through before you can actually get this on the market. The panels that I was looking at on the house are like a thin, wavy plastic over top of the black, kind of muffined heat-saving material. But the whole thing is not really all that thick. It's only about 1 to 3 inches thick. What things are you looking at in terms of the design so it becomes more pleasing to the person who's actually walking by the street and looking at the house?
Already we have seen that industry is implementing photovoltaic panels, which are one color, dark blue, and they are mostly glass. In case of our system, we could consider many different approaches. First of all, the background color. It's enough if it will be dark. It will be a dark blue, dark green, dark red. Actually, any dark color is okay. In terms of glazing, we might use plastic, glass, or textured glass, or whatever, even semi-transparent panels. So we have a lot of options, and good architect putting that together could create miracles.
When do you expect to see this on the market?
Usually, implementation of technology takes 15 years.
But we only have 7, you said.
Yes, this time is shrinking now because we are more dynamic. But still, I think we are facing at least 3 years to get that product finished. But mostly, this is related to funds and resources. And this is my question mark, how much of money I have for that purpose.
It's an incredibly intriguing system, and I sure hope it takes off. Thank you very much, Kaz.
Thanks a lot.
That was Dr. Kaz Shmoka, a research scientist in the Advanced Materials Business Unit at the Alberta Research Council. The search for oil and gas has given rise to numerous concerns over the development of Alberta's north and the impact it has on the boreal ecosystem. Dr. Phil Lee is one of the scientists at the University of Alberta who is researching ways that industry can lessen its footprint in the north through what's called integrated landscape management. One of his latest projects has been a look at the trajectories of how industry develops over time and changes the landscape.
We're looking at a relatively short period of time, so we're not talking about the sort of the deep historical development of Alberta in terms of its being pioneered and homesteaded. We're looking at when basically oil arrived in the province and oil exploration began. So it's about a period of about 60 years in the boreal north.
What are some of the things that you're looking for and what have you found?
Well, what we did was we looked back through aerial photography at the township scale, and we looked at how townships developed over time in about a 2 or 3 year period. And what we found was essentially that the development was very stereotypic. It followed certain patterns almost consistently throughout the land base.
And what might that be?
Well, the initial sort of foray in there by industry was usually through oil and gas, and that was a development of a seismic grid for exploration purposes. After that, there was a well site development. Then a light road network would go in, and that would bring in other features on the landscape, other developments. After that, we had a big timber industry come in throughout the 80s and then especially through the early 90s. After that, there was a certain amount of agricultural development and large road development at that point.
So now that you've found this pattern, how can you use it in terms of how it relates to integrated landscape management?
Well, it does beg the question at this point whether or not a master road network should be put in the north right now. A master road network is one of the key features in development that determine where development should go on, what the timing of that development should take place, and what types of infrastructure should follow that type of development. So roads are one way by which agencies or governments or managers can control what goes on in the north.
So I can see how this might work if you're looking at it from the point of view of economic development, but if you're looking at it from the point of view of protecting the natural resources out there, what does this tell you?
Well, the footprint for seismic in particular, and even abandoned well sites, is as large as, say, something like timber harvest, which is one of the biggest footprints we have out there. The difference between that footprint and timber harvest is timber harvest will eventually be reclaimed to trees. It's an economic incentive to plant trees and want to harvest them again. On seismic lines, there isn't that incentive. In fact, they're left out there. So what happens is they're a persistent feature in the landscape that accumulate over time. Now, new technology has put in narrower seismic, but there's still more seismic going in today than there was in 1960 or 70 or even through the 80s, through the heyday of oil exploration in the north. So efforts should be made to reclaim that because it's a steady erosion of the land base. That erosion of the land base is becoming significant in that it's almost like having another timber company up there cutting down trees, but not replanting trees.
What would be the ecological impacts of this sort of a development trajectory?
Well, one of them, particularly for things like seismic and well sites, is that they're not replanted to trees. And so eventually are converted land base to shrublands or to grasslands in particular. There's four general types of impacts that we've been looking at. One is the overall land loss, and that land loss is fairly significant, and it accumulates over time because there isn't this regeneration to trees. In fact, it's as large as having an extra timber company out on the land base. The second one is more subtle in that because of their nature, their exploratory nature, and their long lines of connectedness, they facilitate the invasion of organisms that are not traditionally associated with the boreal north into the boreal north, particularly grassland and shrubland species from the south. We're already seeing a lot more white-tailed deer and coyotes in the south. As a matter of fact, we now have tracking evidence that coyotes are fairly common in black spruce bogs. 50 years ago, there was absolutely no reports of that occurring in the boreal north, but we believe seismic lines have brought them in. The third thing that we've been looking at is whether or not these lines, because of their width and because they're a different habitat, act as barriers to animals crossing them. And there's some evidence that that does occur. Woodland caribou, in fact, do not like to cross the lines, and such that their habitat becomes more fragmented when these lines exist. And the lines crisscross all over the north. So the habitat is being continually broken up. And lastly is that an effect that, because it's a different type of ecosystem, a grass and a shrubland system, In fact, they can actually support a different type of ecosystem in there. And we're starting to see that ecosystem conversion now from strictly a forested system to one that supports a mix of grassland and shrubland species. And the surprising thing about that, it's been a very small conversion that's actually facilitated that, literally a change in the land base of less than 5% as it currently stands. That'll grow through time. But even at a 5% change right now, we're starting to see more grassland species being supported inside of the boreal forest.
So that's just through this development of seismic lines and well sites from exploration, and it just opens it up that way?
Yeah, it opens up. There's a few key triggers, and seismic and oil exploration was the first. The second one is timber harvest, which comes in after that, and historically, because of timber agreements, has come in after that. The third one is agriculture, which is a permanent land conversion. Those are big triggers in the development of the north.
You found that there's a certain pattern of development. You know that there's concerns about change in the land base. How do you take all of this and turn it into something that you can use to deal with how economic development unrolls and at the same time protect the natural environment?
Well, one of the most important things we can do is put some timelines on how things will develop and how long things will take to develop out in the landscape. And in doing that, we can have some predictability about what the future will bring for us, and hopefully some predictability of the impact on ecology. And the question is whether or not we want to go there. Now, it's a complex issue, obviously, because there are arguments on both sides. There's economic arguments for development, certainly, and there are certainly ecological developments for certain elements of sustainability. The actual tactics in which we'll use to do land planning in the future are unclear. A couple of them that have been thrown out there are, do we live under some sort of ecological sustainability limit? In other words, we can only develop a land base so far before we start pushing out a lot of the plants and animals in Alberta. The second thing that I think we have to look at is whether or not we can try to synchronize activities within an area and leave other areas relatively untouched until we're through that, at least that initial phase of development, and starting to wind down things like timber harvest and leave those areas and go into new areas before. So it's an idea that we would synchronize all the activities in an area and then cease those activities and move on to a new area, hopefully regenerating the forest as we leave. That's an untested idea, and it's unclear whether or not you can actually bring things back to the way they were before. But those are some of the ideas that should be looked at if we want to continue this trajectory of development.
Thank you very much, Phil.
Thank you.
That was Dr. Phil Lee, a research associate with the Integrated Landscape Management Program at the University of Alberta. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. The interviews you heard during this program are posted as audio files and as written transcripts on our website at innovationalberta.com. And you can keep up to date on technology and research events by subscribing to our weekly newsletter, Innovation Alberta Online. Innovation Alberta is sponsored by ICOR, the Informatics Circle of Research Excellence, Alberta Research Council, the NSERC ACR Integrated Landscape Management Research Chair, Alberta Ingenuity, the University of Lethbridge, the Sustainable Forest Management Network, Alberta Conservation Association, Science Alberta Foundation, Ducks Unlimited Canada, and Japan Canada Oil Sands Limited. Innovation Alberta is mixed at Riverdale Recorders and is a Porcupine Stone production. I'm Cheryl Croucher.